from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This fall, students at the nation's state colleges and universities will face the steepest tuition hikes in a decade, increases of up to 40%. Cutbacks in state budgets are largely to blame, and there is growing concern that more and more students may be priced out of a college degree. Tonight on Point, skyrocketing tuitions, and who gets a college education in America today? We begin with a big picture primer on which state schools and students will be hit hardest this fall. For that, we turn to Dale Rusikoff, national staff reporter for The Washington Post, who has been keeping a close watch on tuition hikes. I asked her to give us the hard numbers and their implications.
The in-state cost of public colleges and universities is going up dramatically. Almost every state, the state colleges and universities are raising tuition largely because the states are facing the worst fiscal crisis in decades, and almost all of them have cut very deeply into higher education.
So give us a sense of the arc of increases. What's the average? What are the ones that stand out?
Interestingly, there's no survey that has yet given us an average. So last year, the average was the largest in a decade, and it was almost 10%. It was 9.6. This year, the state university organizations are doing surveys, and they range from very small, there's only three states where it's under 5%. That's like at University of Hawaii, at Manoa, University of Montana, and University of New Mexico. Much more commonly, they're over 10%, double digits. Idaho State is 10%, University of Nevada is 13.7%, University of Kentucky 14%, you know that UMass Amherst is 15%, University of Alabama 16%, University of Maryland College Park 21%, University of Virginia 30%, University of Oklahoma 27.7%. These are all very, very dramatic increases, and they're coming after a period of time in the booming 1990s when state tuitions were in many cases being frozen or cut back.
So what are the consequences of increases of that size? Do families and students simply absorb these increases, or is it pushing young people out of school?
Well, that's a very big concern. I think a lot of groups are wondering, you know, what will this look like in September, October, November? And there's no consistent pattern from one state to the next. A number of states actually raised financial aid almost as much as they raised tuition, so that people would say under $50,000 a year family income would get the increase covered. Other states left financial aid flat, and some states cut it. Massachusetts is one of those states. A number of states are increasing aid that isn't tied to need. A lot of southern states now have these merit scholarships, like Georgia's Hope scholarships.
Why are states so focused on the merit scholarships?
I think that it's part of a whole political attempt to reach out to, quote, middle-class families, so that, you know, if a child has a B average and keeps that average throughout the course of college, they get their tuition paid for whether they have a need or not.
So it's not based on need, but based on test scores and grades.
Yes, right.
What are state legislators saying about this? Is there a backing away from a basic commitment to make college affordable for any American who wants to go? Is that something out of the history pages now?
Well, it's interesting. What they are saying is they're dealing with it more as a state-by-state budget balancing imperative. And they're saying that they have to come up with enough money to balance the budget. And so part of what they're doing is turning to the big-ticket items in state government. Higher ed is one of them. Public ed is another one. Local aid to local governments is another one. Medicaid is another one. Nobody says they want to do this, but they're saying that the budget crisis is forcing it.
And on the student side, how are students dealing with the higher tuitions? Are they just going out and getting jobs, working more hours?
You know, one of the equity arguments is that if you keep tuition low statewide, there's a lot of people who have plenty of income who are being subsidized who don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their parents are paying more, complaining about it, but paying more. There are other kids who are working to help their parents, and so they're working more hours. And then there are kids who are desperately in need of every penny that they can possibly come up with and are already stretched to the limit. I talked to a number of those students in a number of different states, and they're basically either going further into debt, and they're already in pretty deep debt from financial aid and loans, or they're going to work. I've found it's very easy to find students working more than 40 hours a week and carrying a full load. And I guess another issue is you've probably heard and read the teenage unemployment rate and the young adult unemployment rate is going up. So it's very hard for them to find jobs to pay for their tuition.
So even if they want to work, the work may not be there.
That's right. And I actually found a couple of students, and this was not by even looking that hard, who have decided to drop out of school and work full-time and just take a part-time schedule for as many years as necessary, although that was not the main thing that I found as I called around.
And Dale Rusikoff, what about the education that these students are paying these higher tuitions for? Is it improving along with the tuition, or are the budget cuts eating into the quality of the education even as it costs more?
In some states, what you just said is absolutely true. In other states, like, for example, the University of Arizona has one of the biggest increases. Theirs is 39%. But there, the governor, she was committed not to cutting a penny, she said, of the previous year's spending on higher ed because she felt if students were going to pay that much more, they deserve to get something for it. In other states, students are feeling they're paying more and they're getting the same or less.
And finally, Dale, we know that state budgets, the projections don't look too good in the years ahead. Is there a point at which this turns around?
Well, if the economy improves, that will turn it around. One of the things that has been upsetting to a lot of people at universities is that colleges are in this feast or famine cycle where when the budgets are flush, they get plenty of money. When the budgets are down, they get very little money, and it's a pretty hard way to run a public university. So I guess there is a chance that maybe there'll be a whole rethinking of how you fund higher ed and how it relates to state budgets. Miami of Ohio came up with an idea. That's a public university in Ohio, but they have a much higher income on average student body than others. What they've decided is that they're raising tuition to the level of private colleges and just increasing aid for those who qualify on a need basis.
A way of kind of the equivalent of a progressive tax. It means people with higher income will pay more and they'll subsidize the rest.
Exactly right. Then there are others, I think, in Illinois and also in Indiana, some of the state schools are raising tuition for new students but holding it flat for returning students. So at least the amount of money you thought you were going to spend when you came in your freshman year is the amount you'll spend, rather than, say, one of the students I talked to at the University of Iowa is a senior. Her tuition this year is 55% more than it was when she entered, and she's putting herself through.
That is hard to budget for. Dale Rusikoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Dale Rusikoff is national staff reporter for The Washington Post. She spoke with us from New York. So here was the American deal. Study hard in high school, get decent grades, and you will have the opportunity to go to college and a shot at a good job. But that deal is changing. For years, the cost of a college education has been soaring. Now, even state school tuitions are floating out of reach of low and moderate income families, just as the global economy demands a higher education. Should America keep the college door open and college affordable for whoever is qualified to attend? Is it a scandal when young Americans are priced out of a college education, or just tough luck? What's happening to your tuition, your child's? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Buffalo, New York, is David Brenneman, University Professor and Dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. Good evening and welcome, David Brenneman.
Hello.
It's great to have you.
Thank you.
And with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Randall.
Thank you.
So, David Brenneman, you have written that the era of low-tuition public higher education is coming to a close. Why?
Well, the young woman you spoke with earlier, I think, hit a lot of it on the head. The immediate cause, of course, is this unparalleled depression in the state fiscal situation of almost all of the states in the country. My own personal view, speaking as an economist on this, however, is that this isn't just a business cycle phenomenon, which we have every 5 to 10 years. What we've done systematically, I'm afraid, over the last 2 decades at least, is we've just shredded our state revenue structures. We've cut taxes, we've introduced exemptions, we've done any number of things which have put the states in a terrible revenue bind. And then the other phenomenon that I think is driving the state side dramatically is Medicaid. I mean, there's every bit of evidence that the real growth item here that is to some degree uncontrollable is Medicaid, and Medicaid is just squeezing out the combination of Medicaid and outmoded 50-year-old tax systems based on economies that that doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, and which doesn't tax services, doesn't tax internet sales.
So the money is just not there. David Brennan, put in your words, how would you describe the sea change that this is producing? We see these enormous increases that are going on now. Compare it with this new attitude, this new situation that potential American students face today with what they faced in the 60s and the 70s. It's not just a state budget issue, is it? Isn't there also a kind of a change in national presumptions about what the country will do for, will offer to young college-age Americans?
Yes, I think there's been a very significant political shift, which occurred sometime in the last 8 to 10 years, I guess. But we, from roughly the mid-60s until well up into the 80s, there was a very strong political sentiment in favor of access. And access was, in a way, a code word, but it meant making higher education affordable to the very low-income youngsters in the country. Somewhere in the 90s, we lost sight of access, and we began talking about affordability, which sounds like the same thing, but affordability became, again, a code word for politicians. It meant throwing money at middle and upper-income families who were squawking about tuition increases that came out of the recession of the early 90s. And so we generated a whole wealth of tax-deferred savings, 529 plans, tuition futures, state merit scholarship programs modeled on Georgia Hope. So we're pouring resources at people that economists would say, in some sense, don't need it. And that's exacerbated the problem for the low income.
As an educator, David Brennan, how do you see the implications of the country walking away from this goal of access for all?
Well, I think it's tragic in the sense that we've been engaged in a nearly now 20-year crusade to improve K through 12 education, and I mean just think about the title of the last federal act, the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind.
Yep.
Now, if we on the one hand are closing the doors of college through financial constraints and other constraints to many, many young people. At the same time, we're trying to tell them to study hard and get ready for college. I mean, what a crummy incentive system we're creating. I mean, if a youngster, who's maybe on the margin about college anyway, gets a sense that he or she can neither afford it nor wants to borrow the kind of money it would take to do it, so on and so forth, why would they bother to study hard in high school?
Why buy into the education project in the first place? Randall Kennedy, David Brennan describes this as a slow-motion train wreck for the United States.
Well, it certainly is a terrible situation we're facing. On the one hand, we're depriving people of equal opportunity. On the other hand, we're depriving ourselves of talents that people would are going to be left undeveloped. These are people who have shown that they're qualified to partake of higher education, and the only thing that's preventing them from doing so is finances. And that's just what better illustration of the weakness of our allegiance to equal opportunity.
But it's also an issue for American competitiveness, for the health of the American economy long term, isn't it, Randall?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are people that have talents. And we saw this, remember, in the early 1960s. Remember, higher education got a big boost when the Russians put up Sputnik. We saw how education really matters in all aspects of our lives.
The United States poured it on, and things changed as a result.
Things did change. And we are going to rue the day when we slam the doors of a college to people simply because they can't afford it.
Randall Kennedy, David Brennan, stand by. We're talking tonight about skyrocketing tuition at state universities and who gets a college education in America today. Should America keep the college door open to whoever is qualified to attend? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about soaring tuition hikes at America's state colleges and universities and whether this nation is still committed to making a college education possible for any qualified student. Congressman Buck McKeon, Republican from California, is chairman of the House Education Subcommittee. After the August recess, he plans to file the Affordability in Higher Education Act of 2003, which would penalize state schools for extraordinary tuition hikes. Earlier, I asked him to explain why he's putting forward the plan.
The College Affordability Index says that if the school increases their tuition and fees twice the rate of inflation 2 years in a row, they would have to answer to the department. They would have to fill out a form and show a plan that they have to bring their costs into line. If it continues for a third year, then we would be forced to take some kind of action to encourage them to bring their costs into line.
An action like cutting off eligibility for federal student aid.
Of some sort.
Congressman, you know that many state schools are raising tuitions because they're losing funds from the state. What are you suggesting, what are you proposing here that they ought to be doing instead of raising tuition? Should they be laying off professors? Should they be finding money elsewhere? How are they to operate?
Actually, they've been even reducing their share when times were better than they are right now. For the last two decades, public schools have been raising their tuition and fees, averaging about 5% a year. That was in good times and bad. As we've been increasing the federal support, the time I've been chairman of the committee, we've more than doubled the Pell Grant contribution. We've increased money for other campus-based aid. And last year, the federal contribution to higher education was about $65 billion. At the same time, the states have been cutting back their support. It's not just because of this problem that they're having right now with their budget. It's been the trend for two decades. What we're saying is this is a serious problem, and the federal government, the states, the schools, the lenders, the parents, the students all have to come together to solve this problem.
But you know, of course, that colleges have shouted back that they're going to go bankrupt, that this amounts to price controls, it would damage the quality of education. You're suggesting that they could hold tuition down without hurting the quality of education?
We had a hearing last week here in Washington, and we had several people testifying. One was representing a group of schools in Wisconsin that had pooled their resources and had gotten together and used some creativity in cutting costs. 20 schools went together in buying their natural gas. They're putting their financial aid together, saving millions of dollars. We just think that most of the schools are crying that this won't work and that this is a problem. What I'd like to see them do is some of the creative things that some of the schools are doing. All schools aren't raising their tuition. We had a school from Missouri, small school. When everybody else around them was raising their tuition, they made a conscious decision. They cut their fees, they increased their enrollment, they improved their position, and they were able to provide better education to more students.
If tuitions are not held down and the United States gets the split society you described, what would that look like? What are the consequences of that for this country?
It hurts us in many different ways. If you have people that would go to school that have great potential that never achieve that potential, they live a life of frustration. The country suffers because, for instance, I was at UCLA a few years ago, and we had a professor there that was teaching PhD students in science. He was the first one of his family to go to college. He started in a community college. He now has a PhD. He now is teaching PhDs. If he had not had the opportunity to go to school, if he had spent the rest of his life working in some kind of menial task, he would have suffered, but the country would have suffered also because of his lack of productivity and reaching his potential. It's something that hits all of us.
And is that risk in the future, or is it hitting the country now?
It's some right now. It'll just grow if this continues. If this trend continues, it will be one that hurts us more in the future than right now, but it's also hurting right now.
Congressman McKeon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Congressman Buck McKeon is a Republican representing California's 25th District and chairman of the House Education Subcommittee. He spoke with me from Washington. We're talking tonight about skyrocketing state tuitions at state universities and colleges, and who gets a college education in America today. I'm joined tonight by David Brenneman. He's an economist and dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia, and by our On Point News analyst tonight, Randall Kennedy of the Harvard Law School. You can join the conversation as well, and many want to. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Andrea's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in and say that I definitely agree with the idea that when I was in high school, I'm in my second year of college.
Okay.
During high school, I was told you study hard, you get good grades, you're involved in a lot of things, you get scholarships, and, you know, it helps you out. I was a 3.75 student class officer, all these things.
That's pretty good.
And, you know, I can't get enough money. I didn't get a single scholarship. I can't afford the college tuition.
So is it a real make-or-break issue for you, Andrea, or is it just, it's going to be harder for the family?
My parents don't help me out a whole lot. They help me out with little things like gas here and there and things, but for the most part, I pay my rent, I buy my food.
So you're working while you go to school?
I'm working during the school year. I usually work 30 hours a week, and right now I'm working 40 hours a week trying to pay off debt that I have from the previous school year.
40 hours a week plus going to school. Are you going to be able to stay in school?
It makes it a lot tougher. It definitely, my grades have been sacrificed. My GPA is very low because, you know, I have to have a job that's later in the afternoon or later in the evening. And by the time I get home, I'm ready to go to bed and I'm not able to do my homework that I need to. And
right. So there it is. You're right up on the crux of the issue. Andrea, thanks for your call. David Brenneman, you heard the congressman earlier saying, well, his answer is, let's take schools that implement unusually high tuition increases and cut them off from federal aid. Is this a solution? Can there be a cap put on state college tuitions?
Well, I understand the frustration and, you know, where he's coming from, but no, I don't think that's going to work. I mean, the federal government for 30 years has been fussing around about the cost of education, and the simple fact is the way we finance it involves so many different players that it's very hard for any one player to take the lead role and say, we're going to put a cap on and penalize you. Now, the feds could do it. I'm not saying they couldn't, but the tragedy is that we've got a situation that involves state government appropriations, tuition, federal money, institutional aid, private donations. It's complicated. And the tragedy is there's no sort of common place where all of the different players can get together and talk about a common policy. I mean, in particular, just take the federal-state issue. There's no forum for getting together the governors and the legislators in the states and the people in the Department of Education and the Congress to sort of hammer out an agreement on this.
So priorities kind of unfold willy-nilly. Randall yeah. Kennedy, is it possible that in the age of the market-driven world, the market-driven, of course, economy, but more than that, that the very idea of subsidizing education for Americans is out of date, is out of vogue, is no longer appropriate?
Well, it seems that it's out of vogue. It seems to me that it's highly appropriate. I think that what we're talking about here is the logic of growing American inequality. I mean, the story that we're talking about this evening is a story that could be recapitulated in terms of public health, public recreation, the entire public sphere. Here we have institutions of public higher education that are being starved of funds by states, by the federal government. And to make up for it, they're having, of course, to charge higher prices for the consumers. What does that mean? That means that those further down in the socioeconomic system are just having a harder way of it. That, of course, is the way it is across the United States in practically every sphere of life.
But affluent families are paying a lot, too. In fact, at private schools, they're paying enormous amounts, up to $40,000 a year. So maybe everybody's paying more here.
Well, yes, but of course, those who have the money to pay can still go, and they pay. It might be harder for them, but they do it. What we're talking about here is people being actually deprived of an education altogether. To go back to the dean's comment, this we're talking about the access problem, not just the affordability problem.
People who can't even get on the ladder because of that cost of a college education.
That's right. And remember, we're not just talking about just four-year schools. This is a problem that seeps down to the community colleges. Everybody is being bumped down.
Bumped right on down. Randall Kennedy, David Brenneman, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation John Imivar. He's Associate Professor for Academic Affairs at Villanova University. He joins us from Rosemont, Pennsylvania. Good evening and welcome, John Imivar.
Nice to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. John Imivar, what's happening to American attitudes about education that is accepting, tolerating, promoting even this rising bar of college tuition that makes it difficult for some people to get in? Is the country just changing its mind, its attitudes about the necessity of a college education or the advisability of the society subsidizing it?
Well, let's just set the broader context for a second. I work with an organization called Public Agenda. We've been tracking public opinion on higher education for the last 10 years or so. And I think what you see is that in the last 10, 20 years, people have come to see a college education as having the same meaning that a high school education did 20, 30 years ago. In other words, without that, just as people used to say, without a high school diploma, you can't get a decent job. Today, it's without a college education.
But communities are standing up very strong for decent high school educations with new testing and No Child Left Behind. We don't see communities standing up for college education in that same way.
Okay, well, up until now, I think people have, with all their concerns, and they read the newspapers and they read that colleges are charging $40,000 a year, our data show that until fairly recently, people have felt, as much as it costs, somehow we can do it. We see very high percentages of families who say both, I'm worried about the high cost of education, but I think it's affordable.
Not as a society, but as a family. We'll get Jane and Johnny through college somehow.
And the reason they think that is precisely the experience of the young woman we just spoke to, that, well, college is, I might not be able to go full-time, I might not be able to live away from home, but still, I can go part-time, I can work, I can do all those things that she described.
Now, and is that now changing?
No, that's very... Well, first of all, let's just lay that out. And the other thing about college is people think of college as kind of an obstacle course. It's the time where you learn to manage your own time, to be responsible for yourself. So in a way, if it's a little difficult, that's part of what you need to learn. Americans don't like the sort of European idea of college, that it should all be paid for. They like the idea that people should contribute something, that they should work for it. They love the idea of work-study.
Start to get used to the headwinds of life and show your stuff in getting through college.
Right. So all those things are true. Now, however, when people start to see access to higher education threatened, in other words, not just difficult, but threatened, then I think you will see a tremendous spike of resistance, of concern, of outrage, because you're telling people your kids can't be a member of the middle class.
Well, I wonder about that. David Brenneman, if that's true, why haven't we heard more about this in the political realm? As you said, lots of aid has been redirected toward middle and upper middle class families that might have been able to afford college without it. But I don't hear in the early days of the presidential campaign, I don't hear Democratic candidates talking about it much. I didn't hear much about it in the mid-year elections. Where is that political conversation, if it's there?
Well, I think it's a very sad comment, namely the political conversation about this subject over the last 6 to 8 to 10 years has shifted off the kids where money really makes a difference. I mean, the kids who are on the margin of do I go to college or don't I, you know, and it's shifted to the families who are clearly going to send their kids to college, but who are unhappy about the prices they're paying, and I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, the political conversation has shifted, as I said, these code words, you know, access. In fact, maybe in a way, given the kind of society we are, maybe it's a miracle that we had 20 or 25 years of genuine focus on access, because that appears to be an unnatural act in this country.
But it sure felt good at the time.
Yeah, it did, and people, and you know, it makes great sense. I mean, you know, this is basically a knowledge economy, and we are shooting ourselves in the foot if we condemn an entire generation of young people coming down the road, you know, to missing college, and we're starting. You know, we thought we'd gotten past that, and we thought we'd done everything we needed to make sure that didn't happen, and now we're rolling it back. And we're rolling it back in part because this is a classic example of where the politics and the economics part ways. What is good economics is bad politics, and what is good politics is bad economics.
Bad politics because middle-class families are making do one way or another.
Well, because the middle-class families are the ones who vote. In other words, it started with Georgia Hope. In 1993,
this is money being thrown
it's thrown at people whose kids would go anyway.
But these are kids with high grades and high scores
and high incomes.
And Georgia wanted to burnish its image by getting a lot of them under its wing.
That's right. They wanted to keep them at home. It was kind of a brain drain. They were afraid they were losing their bright students to other states.
Well, we can understand that too, and we'll come back and talk about it. I want to turn to John, calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thanks. What's on your mind, John?
I just wanted to say, I just graduated in May from a really expensive private college.
All right.
And my sister is currently attending a state school.
Yep.
But because I got better financial aid from my school, the burden on, you know, my family was about twice as much for her this past year as it was for me.
So you went to an elite private school but had a lot of financial support. She's at a state school without that, and your family's paying twice as much for that education.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, is something wrong with that picture, or were you just such a boy genius that you were right to be so subsidized, John?
No, I think it's a matter of resources, really. I mean, you're going to a school that has a multi-billion-dollar endowment or whatever. They just have a lot more money to help pave the way.
Yeah,
For the students who get in to go there, whereas state schools are just suffering because they don't have these kind of resources.
John, we've got it, and thanks for the call. The billions to pave the way for those who don't necessarily need it, Randall Kennedy. What's the message in all this? Is it, hey, access is old-fashioned. You there, just go on scooping my French fries. College is not for you.
Well, I think that we may be in the midst of a change in basic public philosophy. I mean, after all, we are talking about subsidizing people. Maybe one thing that's being said here is, why should there be a public subsidy at all? Why not make everybody go on their own nickel? What may be in the offing is a rethinking of the basic notions that have surrounded public higher education in the first place. It's an ominous development, but it's one that's staring us in the face, I fear.
Randall Kennedy, John Immivar, David Brenneman, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about skyrocketing tuition at state universities and who gets a college education in America today, at what cost. What's happening to your tuition, to your child's? Is the cost of college floating out of reach? And are low and medium income young Americans getting a fair shot at a college education? Why does No Child Left Behind stop at 12th grade? This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about skyrocketing tuition at state universities and who gets a college education in America today. The question is, should America keep the college door open to every student who is qualified and motivated to attend? How important is this issue? Are you ready to pay more taxes or cut other services to keep higher education affordable? Or is it time for a new deal, a different deal over college? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by David Brenneman. He is Dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. And from Rosemont, Pennsylvania, by John Immivar, Associate Professor for Academic Affairs at Villanova. Right now, we're joined from Iowa City, Iowa, by Mary Rose Wegman. Good evening and welcome, Mary Rose.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
We're great. Mary Rose, the Washington Post found you out there, and you've got an interesting story we wanted to share with our listeners. You're a senior now?
Yes, going into my senior year in the fall.
And the issue of the cost of education at your state school is very real for you. As we understand, you are one of eight children. You've got a single mom who earns minimum wage working at a coffee shop. You're $24,000 in debt at this point. What issues, financial issues, are you facing when you look at finishing college, Mary Rose?
Well, this coming year is going to make it a lot tougher than it's been in the past. Since my freshman year, my tuition has gone up over 55%. And it used to be just around $24,000 or $2,400 for the year, and now we're looking at above $5,000 for the year. So over the past 3 years, I've had to make up, you know, twice as much money.
How have you done that?
A lot of it has come with either taking out more in loans or working more hours an off-campus job. And my sophomore year, I worked over 40 hours a week, and ever since then, I've been working over 40 hours a week. And so this coming year, because I've got to pay $900 more than last year, I'm going to have to make up that $900 through hours.
Is your mother able to contribute, or with the other demands on her income, not?
My mother's never been able to contribute any money to my higher education or to the higher educations of my siblings. Making $5.15 an hour at, you know, a coffee house does not help you pay for the higher education of your children.
So,
it doesn't even help you pay for your K-12 education. She can't pay for book bills. She can't pay for lunch programs and things like that. So,
Mary Rose, given your perspective, can you imagine students or potential students who are simply unable to cut it, simply unable to come up with the money to go to college?
I mean, I think it's a reality that we're faced with now. I am fortunate to receive a Pell Grant, and if I can't afford my own higher education with the maximum funding of the Pell Grant, how somebody who doesn't receive that Pell Grant and receives no parental support through their finances going to be able to pay for it?
So Pell Grant, this is the federal grants for low-income students?
Correct. It's at $4,000 for a maximum, and I received that for the year. And not a whole lot of students do receive the Pell Grant. It's on need-based, and the funding hasn't been increased in a long time, and that's an issue that I think that our national government really needs to look at.
It's not keeping up with tuition. Mary Rose, let me ask you this. We've heard tonight that from John Immerwahr saying college has traditionally been a time when Americans expect young people to kind of prove their steel, to stand up and deal with adversity, you know, study hard, burn the late night oil, and even work if necessary to get through. Is there a point at which you think it might just become too hard, or is this a reasonable challenge that's been put before you in getting through college?
I think it's reasonable for some students, but when faced with, you know, circumstances like my background or, you know, even worse off circumstances, some students just cannot make it through because they don't have the money necessary to pay the bills. And then if they're working this much and they want to go to college, you know, and they're working 60 hours a week to help pay for their education, they're not getting the education that they deserve or the education that they're paying for because there isn't enough time in the day to be able to be a full-time student and more than a full-time employee.
Mary Rose Wegman, thank you very much for joining us with your story tonight. We really appreciate it.
No problem.
Thanks for being with us. John Immerwahr, what do you hear when you hear that story and you must know others like it?
Well, let's add also a demographic dimension to it. You know, if you think about higher education, there are sort of three big waves of students. First, there were the GIs after with the GI Bill. Then were all the baby boomers.
That is, GIs, lots of government support after World War II. Then the boomers, all right.
And the boomers. Now we're seeing a new wave of students, a new young group of young people, and they are, to a much higher percentage, minority, immigrants, Hispanics, African Americans. So this new group is no longer primarily white. And we've studied their aspirations. Like the other populations, they see higher education as the gateway to this middle-class lifestyle and American dream. But if, as our other commentators have suggested, the doors are being slammed, not only are we cutting off access to young people who can contribute to the economy, but that will fall disproportionately on especially African Americans, Hispanics, and the immigrant population. And I think that's also going to cause great social unrest.
Mm. David Brenneman, that's an interesting point, and you write about it. The GI Bill ended up being really celebrated for the way it mixed up American society and got people of all social strata elbow to elbow in the classroom and in many marriages and ultimately job settings and everywhere else together. Is there just less appetite for that mixing now that there are kind of racial stripes to the society more pronounced today?
Well, you know, this is kind of gets me out of my area of any real expertise, but I think a lot of us do worry about this, that, you know, if you look back to this, we don't even have to go back to the GI Bill. We can just go back to the baby boom, you know, the 60s. You know, we turned heaven and earth to build universities. We started, you know, hundreds of community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did everything to get the baby boom generation into college. And of course, a lot of those kids, you know, looked like me, white. And now we have a new echo baby boom that's coming along, and we're not about to, you know, we don't appear to be about to do the same thing this time around that we did in the 60s. And some of us are worried that that's partly because a lot of these kids don't look exactly like me. And you know, maybe the feeling, the bonds, the connection isn't as strong, and so we throw up stuff about, well, we're overdoing it, we're educating too many people, and these kids need remedial education. And, you know, there are a million different excuses you can come up with.
Excuses we did not hear after World War II, or as you say, in the baby boom years. Mohammed's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mohammed, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Finally, I can speak. I have recently... Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I have graduated from Somerville High School this summer.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much, sir. I came to the United States in 1998. I'm an immigrant from Morocco, northwestern Africa.
Okay.
Yes, and I have actually, I worked my way through high school 40 hours a week, and I have kept my GPA as high as 3.4.
So how's it going? Are you headed to college, Mohammed?
Yes, I am, but the chances are very, very slim because I am I live by myself, me and my girlfriend right now, and I support myself as I have done in the past 4 years in the United States when I came here when I was 18. And right now there is no way for me to get to college. I mean, I do believe, I mean, one of the most reasons that governments exist in this world, not just in the United States, is to ensure universal education from its population. I mean, I speak with facts, for example. I mean, we are the richest country in this world, and a large proportion of immigrants and minorities in America are being denied an access to colleges in this country.
So, Mohammed, are you saying in your case that you think you simply cannot afford to go to college?
In a lot of cases, yes. In a lot of cases, yes. I have applied for some scholarships. I have not received any answers right now. My dream actually is to be one of the first people in my family to be a lawyer. And that's one of the things that I, you know, I'm very talented. I'm so frustrated right now because I cannot achieve what I want to achieve. It's like I'm being told that you're going to stay there forever. And the reason why I came to America is to achieve my dream, my own version of the American dream. I mean, for example, I have family that lives in Europe. I mean, we're the only country in the Western Hemisphere, or I should say in the Western civilization, you know, all from Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, that we have to pay for a lot of money to get an education.
Mohammed, we've got it, and we hear your enthusiasm for the debate. Randall Kennedy, what does the United States owe Mohammed?
I think that the United States owes all of the people who are permanent participants in the society an education. And that includes college. And indeed, in my view, would also include professional school. It's not as if education is some sort of thing which an individual gets and then hoards. Education goes for the public. It's a public benefit. It's a public good. The nation, and here I want to emphasize the federal government. The federal government owes it. It should be an obligation to provide resources for those who have the capabilities of taking advantage of the education that would be offered.
Citizen Mohammed, we're rooting for you. Go get it. We hope you find a way. Martha's calling from Spring Green, Wisconsin. Hi, Martha. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to state that I am 100% for accessible and affordable higher education. But one of the things that I've been observing among my peers, I'm in my mid-30s, mm-hmm. is that most of us are overeducated for the service sector and jobs that we're able to get and have to take in order to survive these days.
So when I said the global economy demands a higher education, you're not sure that's right.
Yeah, I'm questioning that a little bit. Wonder how that changes this debate in any way, or if it does.
Well, Martha, let me ask you directly. I mean, isn't the idea that a better educated country gets to stay higher up on that ladder of the global economy, that the tertiary education is supposed to be the thing that helps Americans, you know, not be assembling circuit boards at the same rate of pay as people in Sumatra?
Well, let's hope. However, who's going to serve me my McDonald's now that I can afford it?
Well, there you are. Martha, it's a good question. John Nimavar, what do you think?
Well, certainly the public perspective is that people are not overeducated. The vast majority of the public says we need all the college graduates we can get to really survive and thrive in this new economy. So I don't think that's a general perception anymore, that there are PhDs driving taxi cabs, maybe in today's tough economy, but in general, I think people think we need those educated workers.
David Brenneman, let me put the same question to you. Martha's looking around, and in her direct observation, she sees overeducated people for the jobs they're able to get. So is this a chicken and egg situation here, or how do you interpret?
No, we went through precisely this same experience in the 1970s when, for a period of time, people were in the mid-70s, college graduates were having a hard time getting jobs that they thought they deserved, and there was a popular book written on the over-educated American. And then it turned on a dime, and all the statistics indicate that, you know, the payoff to college in terms of, if you want to look at it as a private investment, has remained very high. Now, we are in a slump right now, you know, in the economy, but I think Martha's experience will turn around as soon as the economy begins growing again.
You say that many states just a couple of decades ago had enrollment-driven funding formulas. That is, if they had more students in the state school, the state shelled out more money for that school. Is that gone now?
It's vanished in a lot of states. It used to be a pretty straightforward formulaic basis, you know, for determining the state's contribution. But really, beginning in the 89, 90, 91 recession, a great many states just dropped those formulas and abandoned them and just said, you know, we're going to cut you a check and we'll give you this much money. And, you know, if you do what you can with it, and if you need to grow, that's figure out the way you're going to do it on your own.
Good luck to you, school, and good luck to you, student. David Brenneman, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and thanks for your insights.
You're welcome.
And John Imavar, thank you to you for being with us.
Great to be talking with you.
John Imavar is Associate Professor of Academic Affairs at Villanova. David Brenneman joined us from Buffalo, New York. He's Dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. Randall Kennedy, in all of this, we hear the sound of a country voting with its feet, kind of walking away from a commitment that it had into some kind of new world that I'm not sure we've fully taken on the meaning of.
Well, we've seen internal secession from the public sphere in other areas. Now we're seeing it in public education. There were two sorts of inequalities that have been voiced in the conversation. One, just straight out class inequality. But then we also heard the murmurings of ethnic racial inequality, the idea being that perhaps one of the reasons why we're not why this is not more of a political issue is that the people who are most affected by it are heavily represented by non-white people. Very disturbing indeed.
Well, a long tale, no doubt, on this subject. We'll be able to watch it for many years. Randall Kennedy, thanks for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.